right, good morning, everybody. Today is Tuesday, March 15th, 2016. And this is Before the First Cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. Happy Tuesday, everybody. It is 49 degrees, and per my little weather app, it says drizzly outside. I was just out there, and it is drizzling, but at least it's springtime here in upstate New York. And though it's dark and I feel like going back to sleep, 50 degrees makes me pretty happy. Where did we leave off yesterday? We're going to continue the show looking at some of the stuff we did yesterday. We titled it Tech Elites Universal Basic Income. Yay! That seems to be their solution. Free money or no free lunch is the question. And we've looked at that. Mr. Feinauer back in 1982 taught us all about how there is no free lunch out there. And this thought that with robots and artificial intelligence taking all of our jobs, the prediction is now 50% or more within the next 4 to 50 years, they've said. And the predictions vary. I mean, some of the tech titans are predicting by the year 2020, we're going to have at least 50% of the jobs. 5 to 7 million, we read also yesterday. That was another number. You know, everybody thinks that it's going to be a different time period or a different number of people, but they all agree that robotics and intelligent machines are going to displace many, many jobs, not only just low-end service jobs, but also high-end white-collar jobs, mid-range blue-collar factory jobs, just about all of them. But don't worry about it because with universal basic income, where they just cut us a check every month and make sure all of our needs are taken care of for us, we will have time to sit around and focus on intellectual pursuits. Lots of creativity, painting, thinking, you know, all those wonderful things that we didn't get to do before. And oh, you wanted to go take a road trip? Well, we have self-driving cars coming to do that as well. You know, humans make mistakes, those puny human brains. But Google self-driving cars, I mean, I know they've had a few little accidents. They just recently hit a bus. Don't worry about it. We're going to fix that with our swarm technology that we're working on, where all of these vehicles can intercommunicate, share information, and ensure that there won't be any more accidents. So, you know, right now, not everybody's on board, but eventually they will be. And our cars will be able to talk to each other. So, there was a story that was mentioned. Oh, yeah, and don't forget, we also have robots evolving now, right? The mother robot building the new baby robots with some of the better features than what she had. We also have the Robo Brain Store, where they're making a large central repository for robots to save information to. And when one robot learns, they are now experimenting with one robot learning and pushing out all of that learning to every other robot that accesses the robo brain in the cloud. So this is going to be a very scary future that we have. We have some good stuff we're going to look at today. So New York Times was mentioned in a story that we read yesterday that there was an article in New York Times that also took a look at universal basic income. And so I wanted to kind of kick it off there, and then we'll kind of spin off and go into some other stuff. A future without jobs, two views of the changing workforce. And this is March 8th, 2016, New York Times. The utopian or dystopian future projected by technological visionaries. Few people would have to work in that. Wealth would be generated by the millions upon millions of sophisticated machines. But how would people earn a living? Well, it looks like Silicon Valley has the answer. Universal basic income. Yay. And what does that have to do with today's job market, with many Americans squeezed by globalization and technological change? Well, two columnists for Business Day, Fareed Manjoo, who writes State of the Art on Thursdays, and Eduardo Porter, author of Economic Scene on Wednesdays, have just taken on these issues in two different ways. So we decided to bring them together for a conversation to help sharpen the debate about America's economic future. Eduardo says, I read your very interesting column about the universal basic income, the quasi-magical tool. Yes, quasi-magical, just money raining from the sky for you, for me, and for Nana. Oh, I read your very interesting column about the universal basic income, the quasi-magical tool to ensure some basic standard of living for everybody when there are no more jobs for people to do. What strikes me about this notion is that it relies on a view of the future that seems to have gelled into a certainty, at least among the technorati on the West Coast. But the economic numbers that we see today don't support this view. If robots were eating our lunch, it would show up as fast productivity growth. But as Robert Gordon points out in his new book, The Rise and the Fall of American Growth, productivity has slowed sharply. He argues pretty convincingly that the future productivity growth will remain fairly modest, much slower than during the burst of American prosperity in the mid-20th century. A problem I have with the idea of universal basic income, as opposed to, say, wage subsidies or wage insurance to top up the earnings of people who lose their jobs and must settle for a new job at a lower wage, is that it relies upon an unlikely future. It's not a future with a lot of crummy work for low pay, but essentially a future with little or no paid work at all. The former seems to me not an unreasonable forecast, as we've been losing good jobs for decades while low-wage employment in the service sector has grown. But absolutely no paid work? That's more of a dream or a nightmare than a forecast, and even George Jetson takes his briefcase to work every day. Da, da, da. Good point! I don't know. All right, and now we're going to look at Fareed Manjoo's take on it. Because I am scared that they will unleash their bots on me, I should start by defending the techies a bit before I end up agreeing with you. So first, I don't think it's quite right to say that the proponents of universal basic income are envisioning a future with no paid work at all. I think they see less paid work than we have today after software eats the world. They say it's impossible that we'll end up with a society where there's not enough work for everyone, especially there's not a lot of good work. They see a future in which a small group of highly skilled tech workers reign supreme, and the biotech industry, guys. Everything, yes, is including a component of technology, but we're going to have a couple of these different areas where it's going to be, and I think Hal talked about this, like the religious class of learning. It's going to be all really super big brain thinking that most common people aren't going to be able to understand. So any mumbo jumbo they give you, you're going to believe it anyway. And you know what? Most of these people aren't going to be doing a lot of the thinking once things like AI Watson from IBM starts getting a handle on, you know, the different chemical compositions in the database, right? They have Watson running already black box drug trials where they're running through the atomic makeups of all these different medications to see whether or not those chemicals in the medications could be used for other illnesses. Ones that they maybe weren't necessarily tested for, but they might have ingredients that would be useful to be utilized. So your research will no longer need to be done by the scientists even. And I'm sure that artificial intelligence could even write up its own scientific paper then and publish it as well in the future, if not already. Anyway, let's go back here. So this is Fareed Manjoo's take on it. They see a future in which most small groups of highly skilled tech workers reign supreme, while the rest of the job world resembles the piecemeal transitional work we see coming out of tech today. Uber drivers, Etsy shopkeepers, and people who scrape by on other people's platforms. Why does that future call for instituting a basic income instead of smaller, more feasible labor policy like the ideas that you outlined? Well, I think that they see two reasons. First, techies have a philosophical bent toward big ideas, and the universal basic income is very big. They see software not just altering the labor market at the margins, but fundamentally changing everything about human society. And while there will be some work, for most non-programmers, work will be insecure and unreliable. People could have long stretches of work or no work, or long stretches of no work at all. And the universal basic income is alone among proposals that would allow you to get a subsidy even if you're not working at all. All right, well, now back to Eduardo. I know what you mean by big thinking. Many of these new technology entrepreneurs think more like engineers than social scientists. Well, you know what? They're both. And not only are they engineers and social scientists, but they're telling you what your future is going to look like. And it's going to be in their vision of Kurzweil's Transhumanist 2045 project. And I don't know about you, but I'm not biting, okay? I don't want Space 1999 2045 here, thank you very much, with nanobots in my bloodstream and my helper robot that follows me everywhere, my implant that records everything I see, everything I think, and everything I do, and uploads it to the cloud for the day I die when I can become a downloadable avatar. No, thank you. Anyway, back to Eduardo. I know what you mean by thinking big. Many of these new technology entrepreneurs think more like engineers than social scientists, yes, and they've declared themselves gods. In the same breath, they will extol the benefits of individual liberty and the market economy and propose some vast reorganization of society following an ambitious blueprint cooked up by an intellectual elite. Zing. But a few months ago, I interviewed, and this is Eduardo talking, Albert Wenger, a venture capitalist you cite in your column, Mangu. He also told me about his vision of a future in which work would be superfluous. Made me think of Aldous Huxley's Brave New World or George Orwell's Animal Farm. Yeah, if you have never read Animal Farm, that's another one to add to the list. I think I did that maybe in junior high school. Maybe it was high school. But that was a great book. If there are, in fact, jobs to be had, a universal basic income may not be the best choice of policy. The lack of good work is probably best addressed by making the work better, better paid or more skilled, and equipping the workers to perform it rather than offering a universal payment unrelated to work, right? To lay around, eat grapes, philosophize, and do nothing. That's going to be helpful. especially for the majority of Americans sitting around philosophizing, thinking about what would... I don't know. Who are even some of the stupid reality TV stars now? What would Bubble Butt do in this situation? I mean, that's what these people... I've met people like this. I mean, they treat reality TV like it is reality. And they're more worried about characters on television than they are about their own mother, who's about to lose her house for not paying her taxes. And these are the type of people that we're going to give this universal basic income because there are no more jobs. So they can sit around and philosophize and be creative and come up with all the problems, all the solutions to all the problems that are hurting us in this world. You really think that's going to happen? Because I don't. You know, for anyone who believes, and they're just rolling this out in Ontario, we read that yesterday, Ontario, Canada, they're going to be the test bed. For anyone who thinks that they're just going to pay you to sit around and do nothing and come up with creative ideas to solve problems and they're going to listen, and that every single, you know, Charlie and Larry, who's collecting this universal basic income, is going to have something that's just so profound, so earth-shaking, that it's going to justify us giving them money for sitting around eating grapes, which, by the way, are going to become rare at some point because of global change, global climate change, mind you. Hey, Larry and George and Sam, these guys are all going to be eating grapes. We're going to have a grape shortage at some point. And then what are we going to do? Well, that's where that bug protein comes in with that 3D printer. You know what, Larry, George, and Sam? We're going to make you citizen scientists. We're going to give you a 3D printer. And we're going to put all this free food in there. Don't worry about it. All you got to do is with your mind-controlled replicator, you don't even have to speak anymore. Think about that delicious pizza that you want. And that 3D replicator is going to create it for you. I mean, I could just see, you know, I've talked about before how we were a giveaway to Big Pharma quite a while ago as they allowed the pharmaceutical and the vaccine makers to experiment upon us without being subject to any type of ramifications anymore if we were damaged by their drugs. Right? They have vaccine court now, but it's very difficult to prove that any vaccine did any type of long-term damage to be able to get a large settlement. You know, they're fast-tracking all this stuff, and with that 21st Century CARES Act that they're looking to push through. And I checked the other day, it still hasn't made it. It was in the Senate or the House. It was in one of them. And it passed and it went to the other. And now it's just been sitting since the end of last year. So nobody's touched it. But what the 21st Century CARES Act is looking to do is to pretty much get the FDA out of the way. Not that the FDA has ever been really any type of protection. And this new clown that they're looking at installing in there is in bed with the pharmaceutical industry. So, how's that going to work out for you? It isn't. It's going to make us even more guinea pigs than we already were. But you know, once they open that door to get rid of liability for big pharma and pharmaceuticals, and I think we've pretty well established here that it's all part of the same military industrial complex, part of the biowarfare program, 1972, when Nixon inked getting rid of biowarfare, he said that we were going to maintain our defensive position with vaccines. And that's where all the secretive research continued. You know, Corbett had a little documentary. We aired it back a few months ago called The History of Big Oil. And it turns out that much of the pharmaceutical industry is the same clowns that are in the big oil. And they're all one in the same industry, which surprised me, Rockefeller Medicine. You know, this isn't an accident. And now we've become, since they've sold off all the fixtures, opened up the back door, chucked them all out, drove off, auctioned them off to China, there isn't much left. But what they do have are human guinea pigs. And precision medicine and all these great new technologies that up until just recently were unethical to be testing such untested technologies on human beings, like nanotechnologies. You know, we were putting nanobots into cockroaches to see what would happen. But hey, guess what? Now in the 21st century, we have all these potentially life-saving cures out there that pesky FDA are keeping out of your hands and Nana's hands. That, you know, hey, roll the dice. Maybe it'll save you. Maybe those little nanobodies will get rid of that big cancerous tumor that was created because of something that we gave you 30 years ago, but you'll never know about it because of plausible deniability that gave you your cancer in the first place. But you know what? Now we might have a cure for it. Or at least, if not a cure, you could be one of our guinea pigs to see how it works out for you. Actually, there was just a story, but I don't want to get too far off the beaten path. Maybe we'll get there tomorrow about these nanobots with the mice. Anyway, all right, let's get back to this before I get too off topic. So back to Eduardo. So Eduardo is questioning this universal basic income. You know, I just honestly, I don't see how this is going to work. If there are no jobs and we have this whole class that's been, I mean, in general, across the board in the United States, the general population has been dumped down. And one of the cries about that H-1B visa, and I know they're pointing at Trump going, oh, you bring in all these foreigners. You know what? I've been in the tech industry for 30 years. And for as long as H-1B visa has been around, we've been using it. And when I was in college in the 80s, guess what? We had a whole dorm that was specifically for Chinese students. You know why? Because there weren't enough Chinese. Well, there were enough Chinese. There weren't enough medical, biomedical, computer science, smart people here. And the Chinese came over. That's all they did. They never went home on vacations. They didn't celebrate any of our dumb holidays. They were here and they studied for 18 hours a day. H-1B visas were always big in the tech industry because we don't have enough mathematical, engineering, scientific minds in the United States to be able to fulfill all the positions that are growing exponentially. Science is the new class. And they encourage multiple generations of our children not to be interested in maths and sciences. I was lucky. I didn't go to school for it, but it's always been a hobby of mine. It was always what I should have done. And it's what I've spent the rest of my adult life studying on my own. I got an English degree, so I can talk about it. And I can slaughter words easily. I'm actually glad I'm not a scientist officially, because then I'd be feeding that machine. But I was an engineer. But, you know, the H-1B visa and bringing in people from other countries because we can't fulfill the mental requirements required to move technology forward is a telltale sign that we had a problem a long time ago, and that problem never went away. As a matter of fact, with 24/7 cable TV, on-demand, video games, smart devices, GMO food, chemtrails, all the other things that are making us sick and dumbing us down, the problem's gotten way worse than 30 years ago. So what do we have left? Jobs are being sucked out. Robots going to take the rest of them. We got this entire population of people that aren't going to be able to contribute to this new hyper-intelligent economy. What does that make us? Well, that's how they sold us. We got rid of Big Pharma's line item budget for R&D. They gave us up as the free real-time guinea pigs, and they spun away. I mean, this new precision medicine using technology to cure you. It's a wondrous new thing. And to keep it out of your hands, people, that is just unhumanitarian. We're going to give it to you, and we're going to give it to you now. any of the newest, biggest, best cures that we have out there. And you're going to embrace it with open arms because we've groomed you to love technology. And that's what they've done. They have sold us. So now we are but lab animals. And very interesting that just recently, and I would say maybe a month or two ago, I just saw that some of the big labs were stopping their testing on monkeys and rabbits and some of the other things that they've used before. And it was heralded as, yes, a great day in science when we no longer are going to use poor lab animals to do our testing. Of course not. You know why they don't need those animals anymore? Because it's you and me. All right. Now, I've digressed multiple times. Let's get back to the story. This is the New York Times. Anyway, Eduardo, he says, in fact, if there are jobs to be had, a universal basic income may not be the best choice of policy. The lack of good work is probably best addressed by making the work better. Better paid and more skilled and equipping workers to perform it. Rather than by offering a universal payment unrelated to work, right, and then having robots do it. Let's not retrain you. We're not going to teach you how to do it. We'll just have robots do it, and you can just sit around and do nothing. The challenge of less work could just lead to fewer working hours. Others are already moving in this direction, and yeah, Obamacare helped that out by making it, I don't remember actually what the full-blown true rules were, but it was if you had so many full-time employees over and above a certain amount, you had to sign on, and there were taxes and all kinds of shit to pay for the corporation. And so what it encouraged was for corporate America to just take all the jobs, make them part-time, and then they didn't have to pay shit. And it would go to the burden of the employee to take care of it and to buy into one of those Obamacare packages that, oh, by the way, are way more expensive than they used to be when you were just getting private insurance. The whole thing is a big freaking scam. And before Obamacare, they had that whole pharmaceutical add-on bill that was like three times more expensive and hundreds of millions of dollars cost the taxpayer. And it didn't help anybody except the pharmaceutical companies. Again, we've been sold. We, you know what? Those fixtures are gone, guys. Those UCCs are all ripped up. And we're the chattel. That's all that's left. You know, we used to joke about China needs your women. I don't think that's a joke anymore, to be honest, because that's about all that's left is human capital. What to do with warm bodies? Anyway, the challenge of less work could just lead to fewer working hours. Others are already moving in this direction. People work much less in many other rich countries. Norwegians, for example, work 20% fewer hours per year than Americans, and the Germans work 25%. They've taken much more of their wealth in the form of leisure rather than money, and that is true. I'm going to tell you, a long time ago I discovered working 80-hour weeks for 15, 18 years straight. I discovered, as I looked in the mirror one day, and I was like, wow, where'd my 20s and 30s go? I got little crow's feet. But hey, I got a bank account. And I thought to myself, you know, what a big fucking joke this is. I just sold my whole youth to the machine for an arbitrary piece of paper that's sitting in an account somewhere for the day when I'm going to retire. That dangling carrot. Except that the joke's on me. Because you know what? The value of that arbitrary piece of paper is dropping every day as they print more and more and more and just pay it out to everybody. It's raining money. So that dollar isn't even worth half of what it was in the beginning. I can't buy what I used to be able to buy with that dollar. And by the time I get to a point where I'm old enough just to kick back and not do anything, like the days of retirement, those were those few golden years where you didn't have to work anymore. and you could relax and be philosophical or just say screw everything and not have to interact with anybody aren't coming anymore. There isn't going to be a happy day of retirement for anybody anymore. Because you can't possibly afford, anyone who's purchased groceries in the last month could tell you that. Sure, gas prices are cheap. I think I saw it here at $1.85, which is insane in New York. Considering we were just not even a year or two ago. What was it? A couple years back. We were almost at $5 a gallon. I think it was like $4.85 here locally. So sure, gas is cheap, but guess what? Those thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of oil jobs down south, especially Texas, have all dried up. All those good paying jobs, all those oil field guys that have $50,000 brand new trucks no longer have jobs because of the $1.85 gas. All right. I've just gotten way off track here. So anyway, I don't know if I even want to continue, and now my flash is crashing, so pages aren't scrolling. So what are your thoughts on the future of universal basic income? Well, my thoughts are, it's a trick. It is a trick. Again, it is to get the Pavlovian. Bernays was in charge of getting you to follow the dangling carrot. The consumeristic society, the I need more, 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 the keep up with the Joneses. They've lulled you into believing that we have to sell our youth, sell our lives to get the arbitrary pieces of paper that then we can exchange for items that we've been convinced we need, we want, we need. They've managed to mix up the meanings of need and want. So we need everything. We need a mobile phone. We need an HDTV. We need all this stuff. And that's a dangling carrot that's going to get them to follow like Pied Pipers. Free money. Free money. We're going to take care of it all. We're going to cover you. Don't worry about it. If part of your getting your universal basic income isn't to get microchipped, isn't to get your little implant for the doctor to make sure you're healthy, to keep your healthcare costs down. You know what? For free money, people will do just about anything, and especially if you have no other choice. Remember, people, there's no free lunch. They're not just going to hand you oodles and oodles of cash and say, go have a nice day, live long and prosper. It's not going to happen. You're going to have to pay for that somehow. Remember free email? Oh, look, free Gmail accounts. Yay, Google's so awesome. Give it up to the machine. Sign up. You know what? Make sure you use this free Google search engine for everything you need to find on the internet because we indexed it all. Make sure you use your Google Voice account and sign up for all this. You signed up for it all. Use Google Maps. Get an Android phone. Oh, Google's so damn awesome. And we gave all of that information, all of that telemetry data, our dossier. We allowed them to build our dossier from scratch, and we gave it all up for free. Because they were giving us quote-unquote free product. I remember in the tech industry, they were warning in the very beginning, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it. Nothing is free, don't do it. Well, we did it. We all did it because it was cool. And now we're all a part of it. All right, so where do we go from here? I don't know. You know what? If I get Firefox working, so maybe I'm going to have to copy. Just give me one second here and paste these links over into this other browser because Chrome, in the middle of my story, started having flash crashes and now everything's flash crashed, but not new. That happens on all of the computers frequently. All right, machine learning algorithms anyway. So we have all of these now artificially intelligent beings, things, creatures, whether they be robots or software applications being developed everywhere. We have these large robo brain stores where the robots and the artificial intelligent machines are going to be able to access groupthink, learn in a swarm fashion, and come up with all kinds of great new ways to do things and to make your future in the 21st century more like Buck Rogers. MIT Technology Review released a story March 8th, 2016, titled Machine Learning Algorithms Aim to Identify Quote Unquote Terrorists Using the V sign that they make with their two fingers, like V for victory. You're like, what? Yes, yes, yes. Every age has its iconic images, and one of the more terrifying ones is the 21st century image of a man in a desert or in army fatigues making a V for victory sign with his arm raised while standing over the decapitated body of a Western victim. Yes, those terrifying images that mainstream news has brought to you full color, full frontal, and a lot of them may or may not have been doctored just for you. Good old Hollywood, aren't they amazing? But in most of these images, the perpetrator's face and head are covered with a scarf or hood to hide its identity. Yes. So you know what? Good thing we have artificial intelligence. Anybody who's trying to hide their identity from the machine, well, we've come up with a way to identify you. That's forced the military and law enforcement agencies to identify these individuals in other ways, such as with voice identification. Oh, here, use your free Skype. We'll give you a free voice application. You can call all your friends and family all around the world. And it's all free. Imagine that, it's all free. Oh, yes, but we now have a very large database with everybody's voice patterns to identify you with. But we didn't tell you that. It's in the small print. Though voice identification is not always easy or straightforward, there is a significant interest in finding new ways of identification. Today, Ahmed Hasnat at Mutut University in Jordan and a few pals said they have found just such a method. These guys said that they have worked out how to distinguish people from the unique way that they make V signs. Finger size and the angle between the fingers is a useful biometric measurement, just like a fingerprint. The idea of using hand geometry as a biometric indicator is far from new. Many anatomists have recognized that hand shape varies widely between individuals and provides them a way to identify, even if the details can be measured accurately. How would we do that? However, the task of recognizing people using just a section of their hand is much harder, and identifying a person with a small part of the hand is a challenging task, and to the best of our knowledge, has never, ever been investigated. So a team began by asking 50 men and women of varying ages to make a V sign with their right hand, and they photographed it several times against a black background with an 8-megapixel camera phone. This produced a database of about 500 images. They then limited their analysis to determine the two endpoints of the two fingers and the two points in the palm of the hand. This allowed them to analyze various triangular shapes between those points, the relative size, the angles, etc. They also used a second method to analyze the shape of the hand using a number of statistical measures, blah, blah, blah. And then they used 2/3 of the images to train a machine learning algorithm to recognize different V signs and use the remaining images to test its efficacy. The results make for interesting reading. Hasrat said that the combination of techniques allows them to distinguish people in the data set with an accuracy of over 90%. And there's a great potential for this approach to be used for the purpose of identifying terrorists. if the victory sign were the only identifying evidence. So something as simple as making a peace sign. How about not a victory sign? Peace. Peace, man. Peace out. People do that all the time. Peace. With that peace sign, they know who you are, even if you have a mask on. Says, but of course, recognizing somebody by a V sign doesn't give you a person's identity. Exactly. For that, the information you would have would be combined with other data. And remember, we already have a dossier, so it shouldn't be too hard. Nonetheless, this curious work reveals how pressures are at identifying nefarious individuals in the 21st century, and they are leading to more and more inventive biometric techniques. Biometrics in the 21st century, and don't worry about it because you won't even be able to get onto the internet at some point in the future without providing some sort of biometric signature to identify you. I don't think that's too far out. Windows 10 is going to be the telltale operating system. And how would they be able to tell? Well, listen, they have a new satellite up there. It is a new 50 trillion with a T, trillion pixel satellite. A new 50 trillion pixel image of Earth is provided every single day. Thanks to a small group of Silicon Valley tech elite satellite startups, we may never look at our planet again in the same way. It's not just that Tarabella Avenue would be an unremarkable street in Silicon Valley. It would be an unremarkable street anywhere in suburban America. The gray brick low rise sits at an intersection in Edison, New Jersey or Skokie, Illinois, and real estate attorneys or school district administrators shuffle in and out every day. But inside one of these buildings, past the cubicles and office kitchen, is a space grade clean room where a man and a woman are dusting off a new satellite the size of a dorm room fridge. They are clad in white, and their workspace resembles an at once an auto shop, a high school robotics lab, and the kind of gleaming NASA warehouse you'd see on Discovery Channel. In the next building over, a mission control center dictates directions to two camera-laden spacecrafts as they travel up and down the Earth from pole to pole every 90 minutes. And with the help of relay towers in Norway, Alaska, and Antarctica, technicians download new imagery and monitor solar radiation through an instrument panel inside of Google Chrome. And behind their hanging array of screens, there are seats for operators during launch and activation. Each terminal just an Apple monitor and a Mac Mini. This is the home of Tarabella, the satellite company formerly known as Skybox, that Google purchased for $500 million in 2014. So this is a Google venture. In the next 18 months, it plans to put more than a dozen of these new satellites in orbit. And this will increase the imagery refresh rate. That is how often one spot on Earth is photographed, and from one new image every 3 or 4 days to 5 new images per day. At how many? 50 trillion pixels. They'll be able to see a fly on your ass from space at that resolution. Tarabella is part of a larger group of satellite companies that promise to transform the way we see Earth. And of course, again, it's all for your benefit. Planet Labs is another, an independent startup based in San Francisco, and it estimates that within the next 12 months, it will have more than 100 satellites beaming imagery down to Earth. That will give it an almost daily image refresh rate, and 12 of those satellites are due to slip into orbit this Thursday. So that was this week. I wonder if that was the launch that just happened. One of them just had a launch recently, within the last week or so. 12 of those satellites are due to slip into orbit this Thursday, care of astronauts. Oh, there you go, on the International Space Station. And more than 2 years ago, I looked at a class of startups that were making Silicon Valley's new spy satellites. And they were, at heart, technology companies of the 2010 vintage, funded with venture capital, of course, well versed in simulating hardware and software and comfortable with the cloud and its metaphors of scale. But they were also space companies. So, I mean, tech industry is invading every industry that exists, people. They were also space companies committed to building custom machinery and getting it into orbit. The profile of many of these organizations has grown since. Terabella has, of course, joined Alphabet. Planet Labs, which was flying just two test doves then, commands 35 now. And analysis companies, including Descartes Labs and Orbital Insight, have also sprouted up around this new bounty of imagery. But however much they've expanded, the coming year will be the decisive year for many of these firms. By the summer of 2017, many promise daily or more than daily refresh rates, and within a few years, hundreds of Earth-observing satellites could float above the planet, each a little more than a camera at the end of a massive and affordable chain of processing, computing, and distribution. There are more than a couple newish companies in the satellite industry. Euthycast, for instance, operates HD cameras on part of the Russian International Space Station. The Vancouver-based corporation purchased two satellites this year, 16 more on the way. Black Sky Global, a startup in Seattle, has also plans to have 60 satellites operating by 2019, and other companies are remaining in quote-unquote stealth mode, meaning that they have not founded or announced anything just quite yet. Yes, gotta love stealth spying satellite companies. Even Digital Globe, a leader in the field, is building six smaller satellites with the help of the Saudi government. Oh, the Russians, the Saudis, and the American tech industries, all in outer space. Right now, Digital Globe rules the business. When you look at pictures of your house on Google or Apple Maps, or when the Red Cross uses satellite pictures to do emergency relief mapping, you are seeing Digital Globe's imagery. But it's Planet Labs and Terabella, who seems to be driving the small satellite industry. Both are born of and based in the San Francisco Bay Area. Terabella's founders often speak of the Stanford class, where they all met. Oh, how interesting. More Stanford elites. Both companies now non-eligible in size. Planet Labs has more than 330 employees, evenly split between space operations and product engineering. And Terabella numbers more than 180. Digital Globe employs 1,300 employees. And despite both manufacturing satellites, Planet Labs and Terabella both downplay their importance. Yes. Instead, both companies are now talking about how their imagery fits into their Earth information platforms that bring together lots of different kinds of data about the planet. Both companies are offering programming APIs aiming to provide something like cloud services for Earth information, as opposed to cloud services for the Earth, which would be something completely different. Both companies are also cagey about what kinds of non-imagery data they could get from these platforms, as well as meteorological and climate data. For Terabella, the uses of this platform eventually could revolve around economic transparency. Their satellites have sufficiently high resolutions to see vehicles, and they record high-definition video. They mention executives working on logistical problems or people checking on a construction project while they're away. And their satellite resolution also puts a solution to the Walmart parking lot problem. an almost infamous idea that financiers could scry the direction of the U.S. economy by tabulating how many cars obscure the blacktops in Walmart's parking lot on a daily basis. Planet Labs tends to focus on different situations. As recently as last summer, it was a, quote, unicorn valued at more than $1 billion. But unlike Terabella, which has leased out some of its manufacturing, Planet Labs still builds all of its extra large CubeSats in the south of market headquarters in San Francisco. Its satellites are a better fit for observing land use, meaning the health and types of agricultural crops, including the extent of logging and deforestation, the availability of water, and the plumpness of reservoirs. Yes, aren't the billionaires going to be so happy with all of this real-time information, like how much water's left in an aquifer and how many crops are left before we go into full starvation mode? Yeah, this is going to be wonderful. Last year, it started also giving imagery to newsworthy areas like the Syrian-Turkey border to outlets like the New York Times. Planet Labs also works outside firms that use computers and machine learning algorithms to watch crops and land changes. And for a long time, such analytics required human experts, but no longer. Ha ha! These companies include Descartes Labs, whose programmatic predictions of the annual corn yield could prove more accurate than the USDA's. In August, a Bloomberg News story about Descartes estimates moved the national corn market by 3%, and Planet Labs also works with more farmer-focused services like Farmer Logs, Farm Logs, and Farmer's Edge. And do we continue? This goes on and on and on. So they're going to use this. Oh, yeah. They're going to also look at greenhouse gas emissions, deforestation, agricultural land use. And with it's all imagery everywhere, anytime service, Planet Labs could initiate or assist with, quote, global measuring and verification systems for carbon output as well. Yeah, people, the bag is closed. Our overlords have now launched surveillance in space 24/7 at 50 trillion pixels multiple times a day. There's no getting away now. None. By combining images of noticeable economic activity and all major land changes, such a program could be a definitive, factual, unbiased account of the world's carbon system, and its database could then help arbitrate an international cap-and-trade scheme. Oh, yes! Or some other global carbon pricing system. What a great idea, guys. Recently, certain types of people, venture capitalists, convention hall exhibitioners, and think tank soothsayers, have all talked of a space renaissance. There is even a bill with that name currently under consideration in Congress. And if all these folks aren't wrong, inexpensive hardware, advances in software, and more frequent rocket launches have made it cheaper to hurl something into orbit. And the White House apparently preparing for hundreds of new civilian satellites this decade has indicated that it might move orbital air traffic control from the Air Force to the FAA. And we read about that, not only the FAA, but they were working with the FCC, Verizon, and 35 other tech companies for the low orbit tracking for unmanned aerial drones, which is also coming this year. Delivery drones, ding dong. Satellite imagery will not be the last outer space enterprise altered by these changes, but it will be one of the businesses where we feel the most consequences. Yeah, that's a good one. The way they put that. The consequences. All right, well, let's see if I can get to one of my last stories here. And don't worry about it, because with your HD video and all of your AI algorithms out there, your universal basic income, your self-driving cars. You can go on vacation anytime, anywhere. Go, James. That's your name of your car. Let's go to the mountains. I need to get some pretty pictures. There's a new algorithm that allows computers to take images and create a highlight vacation video just for you without you even having to do any work. Hey, researchers at the Georgia Institute of Technology have unveiled a novel video editing solution this week that automatically sorts and edits untouched footage into the most picturesque highlights from a vacation reel that could fill anyone with envy. This new approach is an algorithm that analyzes video for images with ideal artistic properties. It first considers geolocation, then composition, symmetry, and other vibrancy to determine what is important or picturesque. And video frames with the highest scores are processed into a highlight reel. So not only are they looking at how beautiful the images are, symmetry and coloring, but geolocation. Yes, we know where you took that picture. We're going to put it into a nice edited video with your highlights to help you remember, because we know that the adult attention span is only that of a goldfish now. So don't worry about it. We'll make sure we edit your videos automatically. You won't even have to think about it anymore. The algorithm turned 26 hours of video into a 38-second highlight reel in about 3 hours. It captured GPS data, and the algorithm filtered it by geographical location, and that reduced footage to 16 hours, and then they sliced it down 1,700 shots into about a 38-second reel. So how nice is that? Make sure they give that to the dashboard camera police so they can edit down their 8-hour shift. All right, guys, make sure you stick around. Mr. Kevin Blanch is up next. It is Tuesday. Lots of live radio tonight. Ron live at 7, 8, Tim Kelly, 9, the boys from Primer Time, 10, Geoengineering Watch with Dana 11. I said, thanks for the experience.